All right, here we are. We've picked up a few new folks for the afternoon, so that's good. Traded out a few, yeah. So we're excited to have Joseph Henderson here with us. Joseph is a writer and adjunct instructor at York Tech. He's currently pursuing an MA in English at Winthrop University and completing a thesis on nature in Cormac McCarthy's Border Trilogy. He's recently applied to a number of PhD programs and hopes to one day be published in the Oxford American Magazine, which would be excellent.
Yeah, so.
So we've been reading a little bit of Annie Dillard through the time so far, and now we're just going to hear a couple of readings from the other authors that Joseph's going to be touching on. So if we could have Laura, and then Andrew's going to read. And this is from Cormac McCarthy, All the Pretty Horses.
The rain had ripened all the country around the roadside grass, was luminous and green, from runoff and flowers, wherein were in bloom, across the open country. He slept that night in a field far from any town. He built no fire. He lay listening to the horse crop the grass at his stake rope, and he listened to the wind in the emptiness, and watched the stars trace the arc of the hemisphere, and die in the darkness at the edge of the world. As he lay there, the agony of his heart was like a stake. He imagined the pain of the world to be like some formless, parasitic being seeking out the warmth of human souls, wherein to incubate he thought he knew what made one liable to its visitations. What he had not known was that it was mindless, and so had no way to know that the limits of those souls, and what he feared was that there might be no limits.
This is from Barry Hanna, Yonder Stands Your Orphan. Episcopals, your rituals are babble, it muttered, robed baboonery. Lukewarm, I spit them from my mouth, even while loving them and their gold and whiskey and cable-knit sportswear. You are post-war, post-modern, post-human. You sweep up is all. The waste of the stores and storerooms find their place in each consumer heart to rot and reek. You are lukewarm, my people. No decisiveness, saith I the pastor. The man who owes thousands to the pimp who butchered him. Something large is in the woods, not what you planned. You have not decided, so the thing in the woods is deciding.
All right, on that happy note. So the title of my paper is Large and Startling Figures, The Shock of Mystery in Barry Hanna, Annie Dillard, and Cormac McCarthy. And what I had conceived of doing with this paper is a little different than what I normally do, which is, I guess, a little bit more dry and academic and theoretical. But I wanted to take the source of my title quote, Large and Startling Figures, that comes from Flannery O'Connor, and to sort of engage her in a dialogue with what I see as a thread through some of these other writers. So, bearing that in mind, I want to start. In its inception, this essay began as an exploration of the grotesque in the work of three Southern writers I love, struggle with, and am confounded by in equal measure. Since then, I have redirected my lens away from this original focus on the grotesque, as Flannery O'Connor defines it in The Grotesque in Southern Fiction, to a much closer reading of her words, where I'm starting to see past the shock of excessive imagery to her emphasis on the greater reality of mystery. Describing works that, in her words, are grotesque because of a directed intention that way on the part of the author, O'Connor writes, "In these works, we find the writer has made alive some experience which we are not accustomed to observe every day. or which the ordinary man may never experience in his ordinary life. Their fictional qualities lean away from typical social patterns toward mystery and the unexpected. All novelists are fundamentally seekers and describers of the real, but the realism of each novelist will depend on his view of the ultimate reaches of reality. Mystery and reality jump off O'Connor's page like sparks from a fire. They are the luminous core in our articulation of the non-ordinary. Continuing in her challenging definition of the writer, O'Connor argues, if the writer believes that our life is and will remain essentially mysterious, if he looks upon us as beings existing in a created order to whose laws we freely respond, then what he sees on the surface will be of interest to him only as he can go through it into an experience of mystery itself. Such a writer will be interested in what we don't understand rather than what we do. He will be interested in possibility rather than probability. He will be interested in characters who are forced out to meet evil and grace and who act on a trust beyond themselves, whether they know very clearly what it is they act upon or not. Well, I have to resist the temptation to quote O'Connor's brilliant essay in total. In these few sentences, we find the terms for discussion and debate that will carry me through my brief survey of Hannah, Dillard, and McCarthy. Evil, grace, trust, mystery, surface. Words Harry Cruse calls all those abstract nouns. These monolithic concepts inform my central argument, broad though they may be. In each of these writers' works, the visionary mode, both seeing and dreaming, suggests the reality of a greater mystery, though how the writers or their characters respond to that extended reality varies wildly. Mystery is an object of endless pursuit for Barry Hannah's characters, however violently they might stumble into their bliss. Seeing is equal to revelation for Dillard, and in Pilgrim at Tinker Creek is her story of learning how to see right and with purpose. McCarthy offers us a more difficult metaphysic still. Visions happen. Dreams reveal greater orders in the world. And characters offer hypotheses about cosmic correspondences in eternity. These glimpses into reality's depth are never meant for the protagonists alone. They dumbly ignore them or fail to act on them, and they are left for the reader's own reckoning. Though these writers approach the subject of mystery with a different gait, their artistic debt to O'Connor is clear and undeniable. As seekers and describers of the real, they choose to focus on those monstrous abstractions we don't understand, rather than the smaller, probable things we do. In what follows, I will explore two essential phases of extensive reality for these authors and their characters: experiences of vision through physical sight or dreams, and encounters with mystery as overwhelming desire or the revelation of a greater order in the world. So, vision and acquaintance. I organize my discussion in these terms to consider these writers as heirs to O'Connor's concern for mystery. Because sight precedes insight for Paul, Oedipus, and O'Connor's own Hazel Mote's, I recognize that we must start with vision. The faculty of sight and the power of vision are great matters in Hannah, Dillard, and McCarthy. McCarthy's teenage cowboys in the Border Trilogy are constantly watching the country, awaiting an encounter over the next ridge. He populates his novels with characters who dream of wild animals mourning the loss of their own, of fathers carrying fire and a horn, of tragic mothers lost to suicide in the days before the world changed forever. Though Billy Parham has many dreams in The Crossing, the following illustrates the oblique nature of vision in McCarthy perfectly. This is from The Crossing. He'd had a dream, and in the dream a messenger had come in off the plains from the south with something writ upon a ledger scrap, but he could not read it. He looked at the messenger, but that face was obscured in shadow and featureless, and he, that the messenger was, messenger alone, could tell him nothing of the news he bore. While an indecipherable ledger scrap is often the only clue into the nature of the wider world, some of McCarthy's characters experience momentary glimpses into something transcendent. Early in All the Pretty Horses, John Grady Cole breaks a number of wild horses on Don Hector's ranch, and afterwards he attempts to locate his own position within the greater order of the universe. And this is from All the Pretty Horses. He lay looking up at the stars in their place, and we've already read this, but in their places in the hot belt of matter that ran the cords of the dark vault overhead, and he put his hands on the ground at either side of him, and he pressed them against the earth. And in that coldly burning canopy of black, he slowly turned dead center to the world, all of it taut and trembling and moving, enormous and alive under his hands. Vision runs the gamut from oblique to overwhelmingly sublime in McCarthy, as his characters dream of language disintegrating and the frightening vitality of the world. For Dillard, seeing splits into two distinct tasks, divided between the kind of seeing performed by the prying analyst and the emptied, unscrupulous observer. In her chapter entitled Seeing, Dillard channels Ralph Waldo Emerson when she describes this second visionary mode, calling it another kind of seeing that involves a letting go. The difference between the two ways of seeing is the difference between walking with and without a camera. When I walk without a camera, my own shutter opens, and the moment's light prints on my own silver gut. In Dillard's hands, the act of seeing is connected with the act of witnessing, because, as she writes, our life is a faint tracing on the surface of mystery, like the idle, curved tunnels of leaf miners on the face of life. We must somehow take a wider view, look at the whole landscape, really see it, and describe what's going on here. Then we can at least wail the right question into the swaddling band of darkness, or, if it comes to that, choir the proper praise. So the problem of vision is a problem of access and orientation. By looking with a wider view, or anticipating what O'Connor calls the ultimate reaches of reality, we might begin to articulate the right sort of response to the depth of mystery, plumbing the swaddling band of darkness for the line of best fit. Barry Hannah's characters are wild and varying in their depth and desire. They are a different class of seeker from O'Connor's writer. They know not what they long for, only that the itch is there. This gnawing lack is the result of loss, frustrated sexuality, or a confused sense of masculinity. In a story titled Ride, Fly, Penetrate, Loiter, Ned Maximus embodies each of these sources of tension and desire as he narrates his story of losing an eye, which gives him a new sort of fatalistic vision. Recalling the moments before this loss with great clarity, he muses, "The last thing of any note I saw with my right eye was a Dalmatian dog run out near the road, and this was wonderful in rural Mississippi, practically a miracle. It was truth and beauty, like John Keats has in that poem. And I wanted a dog to redeem my life as drunks and terrible women do." In another story, entitled Two Things Dimly Were Going at Each Other, Hannah gives us an unlikely hunter and quarry pair, an old man named Coots, who is off 40 years of morphine, as he puts it, longing only to see a death in the big city, and a barely retired surgeon named Latouche, who suffers from groft, a rare Central American disease making one hunt like a dog, bark and whine, the face becoming wolfish. Coots' pursuit of Latouche becomes a story about the apparent necessity to destroy a beloved object, forcing the vision towards a terminal point. Finally, in the comic and tragic story, Get Some Young, Hannah imagines a pair of convenience store owners who have sunk their fortunes and dreams into a frustrated future of violent domesticity. Hannah illustrates Tuck and Bernadette's diminishing returns perfectly in his opening line. Since he had returned from Korea, he and his wife lived in mutual disregard, which turned 3 times a month into animal passion, then diminished on the sharp incline to hatred, at last collecting in time into silent, equal fatigue. Yet Tuck and Bernadette, much like Coots and Ned Maximus, project their misspent youth and frustrated lust onto another person. In this case, the couples fixate on a young man named Swanley, leading them all into ruin. Vision is afforded a significant place in each of these stories, whether personal or fictional, playing a curious role in the authors and characters' lives. Though I've examined the moment of vision and the importance of the act itself, I want to shift to the objects perceived and explore their connection with a broader notion of a deeper reality. When O'Connor writes about the experience of mystery, I believe she is also talking about recognition, or the act of looking with an intuitive knowledge about the object of our vision. But how can we characterize this mystery? Annie Dillard provides us with the most provocative answer. Acknowledging that the world we see and understand is temporal and unpredictable, Dillard returns to her initial description of life as a faint tracing on the surface of mystery, this time continuing beneath that surface to give character to its essential intricacy. And this is a quote from Dillard. The surface of mystery is not smooth any more than the planet is smooth. Not even a single hydrogen atom is smooth, let alone a pine. Freedom cuts both ways. Mystery itself is as fringed and intricate as the shape of the air in time. Forays into mystery cut bays and fine fjords, but the forested mainland itself is implacable both in its bulk and in its most filigreed fringe of detail. Certainly nature seems to exult in abounding radicality, extremism, anarchy. If we were to judge nature by its common sense or likelihood, we wouldn't believe the world existed. In nature, improbabilities are the one stock in trade. The whole creation is one lunatic fringe. Dillard's description shuttles between the duality of nature's improbability and intricacy, an ecological sublime that terrifies and amazes with equal force. Closing her chapter on intricacy, Dillard ruminates on the surprising presence of beauty despite this great complexity, writing, The wonder is that all the forms are not monsters, that there is beauty at all, grace gratuitous, pennies found, like mockingbird's free fall. Beauty itself is the fruit of the creator's exuberance that grew such a tangle, and the grotesques and horrors bloom from that same free growth, that intricate scramble and twine up and down the conditions of time. Beauty and horror are fruit from the same vine, bound up with each other as necessary conditions for their own existence. Mystery, for Dillard, is contained in the sheer breadth of reality, in the capaciousness of that reality as it points back towards the infinite. The shocking intimacy of beauty and horror is not a foreign topic to Hannah or McCarthy's fiction. As I've already noted, Dillard articulates an aspect of this artistic vision in clearer language than either of them might use. Yet for Hannah, beauty becomes a thing that, once pursued, is soon lost and destroyed. Tuck and Bernadette's perverse yearning for the young Swanley in Get Some Young climaxes into an escalating scene of depravity and desertion as their post-coital idols are interrupted by the local hermit Sunballs, who spies on the three from an adjacent window. This competing vision transforms their impression of Swanley. He was not the bright shadow of their childhoods anymore. He was not the boy almost he was not the boy of almost candescent complexion. He was not the pal haunting in the remove of his beauty. This beauty had been a strange thing. It had always brought on some distress and then infinite kindness in others, and then sadness too. But none of them were cherubs any longer, and they knew all this and hated it. Seeing him now across the woman's lap, her breasts all over his twisted face, he was neither child, boy, nor man, and he was dreadful. Like Dillard's uncertain atoms once observed and possessed, Swanley's beauty vanishes, and any false innocence that Tuck and Bernadette had projected onto him disappears with this ideal. Similarly, after Latouche's death in Two Things Dimly, Coots finds himself shuttling between relief and disgust. Nature did nothing more, but the city became louder. Horns, screeches, a ball game, airplanes, it was all obscene. "Oh, yes, I saw a death, Harry." He stopped. Coots's eyes became misted and blind. This was all right. This was fitting. "But what a gap, Harry. What an awful gap you leave." Harry is Latouche's first name. "And I only a watcher." What vision reveals, it conceals or reconfigures with equal force, leaving these characters bereft and listless in its wake. Where Dillard plays hunter to mystery's quarry, Hannah's characters grasp so violently after what they can't understand, destroying it or themselves in the process. In his own oblique way, McCarthy answers Hannah's lusty craving visionaries in the puzzling epilogue to Cities of the Plain, the third and final novel of the Border Trilogy. Though the trilogy as a whole imagines the tragic struggles of its two major characters, John Grady Cole and Billy Parham, as figures with a shared, doomed fate, the epilogue that closes the trilogy offers a baffling coda to the previous tales of doomed love and itinerant wandering. After John Grady dies in a brutal street fight with a Mexican pimp, His protector and surrogate brother, Billy Parham, chooses to wander the West with little plan or purpose, a strategy that lands him under a bridge in Arizona. Though he spends many nights dreaming of the people and world he has lost, a mysterious stranger who discusses the meaning of dreams with him punctuates Billy's despair with a philosophical departure into the nature of reality. While recalling a dream that led him to draw a map of his life, the stranger tells Billy, "It is difficult to stand outside of one's desires and see things of their own volition." To which Billy responds as the eternal realist, "I think you just see whatever's in front of you." And the stranger again, "Yes, I don't think that." Here, the stranger and Billy return us to O'Connor's original distinction about the extent of reality. The mysterious and desirous within us become more real once we consider them as a phase in reality's continuum. The stranger goes on to describe an elaborate dream vision that offers a multifaceted allegory on reality and story as a necessary condition of existence. As his own dream becomes another dreamer's dream within the original frame. Now, if you understood the movie Inception, and I'm not entirely sure that I did, then maybe you can follow the logic here. The dreamer within the dream is captured, led to a sacrificial altar, executed, and he wakes up in the same world without danger, but not without giving a poetic oration on the knowable world first. What he saw was the strangeness of the world, and how little was known, and how poorly one could prepare for aught that was to come. He saw that a man's life was little more than an instant, and that as time was eternal, therefore every man was always and eternally in the middle of his journey, whatever be his years and or whatever distance he had come. In the end, the stranger explains the dream as a discourse on story, acknowledging that vision can reveal the narrative and creative truth about the world. Explaining memory in the way we shape our own journeys, the stranger tells Billy, "These dreams reveal the world also. We wake remembering the events of which they are composed, while often the narrative is fugitive and difficult to recall. Yet, it is the narrative that is the life of the dream, while the events themselves are often interchangeable. The events of the waking world, on the other hand, are forced upon us, and the narrative is the unguessed axis along which they must be strung. It falls to us to weigh and sort and order these events. It is we who assemble them into the story, which is us. Each man is the bard of his own existence. Seeing is revision, which is really another form of writing. McCarthy's stranger is less concerned with wailing the right question into the darkness than properly weighing and sorting out the events of his own story. To conclude, I want to return to the source of my title, Flannery O'Connor's other masterful piece on writing, The Fiction Writer and His Country. In this essay, she connects a writer's spiritual worldview with an awareness of the grotesque, arguing that writers who see by the light of their faith will have, in these times, the sharpest eyes for the grotesque, for the perverse, and for the unacceptable. In other words, those that grapple with a deeper sense of mystery and the extensiveness of reality are considerably more sensitive to the monstrous inhumanity and the reality of evil. She continues in this vein. The novelist with Christian concerns will find in modern life distortions which are repugnant to him, and his problem will be to make these appear as distortions to an audience which is used to seeing them as natural. And he may well be forced to take ever more violent means to get his vision across to this hostile audience. When you can assume that your audience holds the same beliefs you do, you can relax a little and use more normal ways of talking to it. When you have to assume that it does not, then you have to make your vision apparent by shock. To the hard of hearing, you shout, and for the almost blind, you draw large and startling figures. In the end, O'Connor leaves us with more questions than tidy resolutions. By reading her through works by Hannah, Dillard, and McCarthy, I hope to have provoked and challenged their own texts to illuminate them by her own light. Though we can't say for sure what these characters or their authors know, we can look closer at their own insights into mystery. Thank you.
So go ahead and stand up here. We'll just stand and talk while we're...
Okay.
That was good. I wanted to thank you for setting me up very nicely tonight, by the way.
Oh, good.
Talking
great.
About mystery.
No, yeah.
I was recently reading a book that takes in Celtic culture. Mm-hmm. And one of the parts of Druidic culture before St. Patrick came along was the value of the bard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You said here towards the end, each man is the bard of his existence.
Mm-hmm.
play that out a little bit more for us. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's actually a line from McCarthy, mm-hmm. and that's from the epilogue to Cities of the Plain, and the conversation that this mysterious stranger figure is having with Billy Parham, I think, is not just about, well, it is about story, but it's about more than that, because I'm just going to give a little more summary and kind of set this up, and maybe I can. But after that scene, after he has this long talk about dreams and dreams within dreams and what they mean, and you know, we have this line, each man is the bard of his own existence, mm-hmm. and you know, this stranger is continuously trying to convince Billy, I think, that there is a greater reality in the world just beyond what's in front of him and what's coming around mm-hmm. the bend. And I don't know that Billy ever buys that. Mm-hmm. But in the very end of the novel, Billy leaves Arizona and is taken in by this woman, and he's given a place to sleep and rest, and he's telling her, it's this really wonderful scene, he's telling her that, you know, well, she doesn't know his story, and she doesn't know who he is, and she doesn't know all the things he's done and seen and been through. And she tells him, we do know who you are. And I forget the last line, but she tells him that she knows that they know who he is, and it's, and the novel and the trilogy just ends on this question of whether we have sort of choices, whether we create our story, I guess, whether we create these narratives around ourselves, or whether we're all moving towards some sort of final point anyway. Mm-hmm. It essentially, I remember a little bit more about that last scene now, but she says, we know who you are and we were waiting for you. So then there's the question of whether, okay, is this a matter of, well, free will or predestination? And if it's a matter of a man being a bard of his own existence, I think what McCarthy is maybe trying to get at there is less about creating a fate or creating a journey for ourselves, and more about recognizing our place now, like right. recognizing where we are in the moment, and also finding a language to articulate that.
Because it's interesting, bards weren't just storytellers, as you're kind of referencing here, but mm-hmm. they were also kind of the monks and spiritual mm-hmm. guides of their mm-hmm. communities, but they were not only storytellers in that, but they were also the historians.
Yeah.
But they used those two other forms in order to kind of communicate. So there was some mm-hmm. knowledge of reality. This is where our tribe, our community has come from.
Sure.
There's a mystery in the spiritual sense, but then there's also, we need to tell it in a format that is not just the analytical.
Right.
These are the points in history, the dates you must remember type yeah. thing, but these are the great stories of our people, that type of thing.
Sure.
But it made me think about that as you were
yeah.
bringing up that point,
yeah.
which is kind of interesting, because you're talking about, used a lot about reality and mystery,
mm-hmm.
and that those kind of roles of a bard kind of come together with historian, kind of spiritual,
right.
and then
yeah.
storyteller. Because that also came to mind was, of course, the purpose behind Jesus of Nazareth telling parables was mm-hmm. the seeing aspect, seeing that they may not see. There was you mm-hmm. just get the sense that he was, I don't want them to see, so I'm going to tell this in a mysterious type of way.
Yeah,
which came out kind of as a story.
That reminds me of. Something that I'm taking a modern American poetry class right now, and we've just finished talking about Emily Dickinson,
mm-hmm.
and Dickinson has this, well, she, in one of her letters and in one of her poems, she talks about the idea of circumference. She says, my business is circumference. Uh-huh. And the way that I think you can explain that is it's the point, the thing, the mm-hmm. thing itself is not the point.
Right.
But rather going around it and describing, going through the back door in a way.
Well, the Tell It Slant poem.
Exactly. Tell the truth, but tell it slant.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Success and yeah. circuit lies. Right. But that's exactly what you're making me think mm-hmm. of there with this idea of the parable
right.
and accessing reality, but then also what's behind reality.
Right, which is kind of the context. Well, not just the context. It seems like it's the characteristic of art, whether visual or like we had Luke speak this morning mm-hmm. and then this afternoon, and also had Casey.
Mm-hmm.
Those are levels of indirect communication, and mm-hmm. yet they are perhaps following Dickinson's circumference. Let's look at this scene. But it's not really a scene, as Luke said. Those are scenes I've seen in my mind that I've put together into this one reality.
Sure.
Tolkien called it feigned history, I think, is one of the reasons.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting. Do you have any questions out there for Joseph about anything you said? Really? Oh, come on.
I've got one.
Sure.
Could you just comment on the section where you were talking about the beauty and poor, was it? Or
grotesque.
No, it wasn't grotesque. It was beauty and...
The quote from Annie Dillard.
Beauty and horror, right?
Yeah.
Could you comment on that?
Or maybe read that part again?
Sure, I can go back to that. Let me see. And now I've actually done what I didn't want to do, which is mix my pages up. Let's see. Where are we here? This is in her chapter on intricacy, and she says, the wonder is that all the forms are not monsters, that there is beauty in all, grace gratuitous, pennies found like mockingbirds free fall. Beauty itself is the fruit of the Creator's exuberance that grew such a tangle, and the grotesques and horrors bloom from the same free growth. That intricate scramble and twine up and down the conditions of time. So it's that all of it is essentially the fruit, if I understand her correctly, and I don't know that I entirely do, but that all of it is the fruit of this sort of generative urge, because she's talking about nature, and she says, you know, elsewhere she says, you know, that it's all essentially anarchy. The whole creation is one lunatic fringe. So for her, the real wonder is that beauty ever happens within nature. That there is, that we can find some sort of order because there's just this great proliferation of so many things. And she writes a lot about, she writes as well about violence and sort of the inherent violence in nature. I believe you guys read the quote earlier about where she uses this image of these arrow shafts that were crafted by Native Americans with what she called what we call them, lightning channels
yeah.
And that the channels themselves were there so that, you know, that the hunters could trace the blood of the deer as they were running away. And that her own writing is, she wants it to operate much like those lightning channels. That while there is beauty and there is beauty to be found, it's almost like it can't exist without the horror,
without
and the grotesque, without the blood
right.
that's sort of bound up within it, you know, without this image of violence. It's almost like the... Yeah, it's almost like a film image, you know, that you can't have the positive without the negative of its
without contrast it becomes meaningless.
Exactly. I don't know. Does that answer?
Yeah, what I'm what just. I was. At? I don't know her. I know Flannery Connor a lot better. I've read the essays you're mm-hmm. talking about. I dearly love them.
Yeah.
A Christian's view of beauty and twistedness would be not that twistedness is the norm, and that points of beauty are an anomaly in that, but rather beauty is the norm. Beauty is what has been there since all eternity, mm-hmm. and horror and grotesque mm-hmm. are something that's come later that's been twisted. In mm-hmm. other words, creation's been twisted. Mm-hmm. Something's gone wrong with nature. So I was wondering what that how different that writer's worldview was from Flannery O'Connor's.
Well, I would argue that their worldviews are probably fairly similar, mm-hmm. but I think that maybe the slippage there is somewhere in the semantics of nature. For her, she's talking about nature as in nature, biology, not nature as human nature so much. Mm. And that in nature, the rule is towards proliferation, reproduction,
strong,
death,
weak, nice.
You know, consumption, mm. And on and on and on. Mm. So in that, you know, for her, images of horror are, like, I think about this really, really famous image at the beginning of Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, where she's admiring this frog, and the frog is, like, floating on the surface mm-hmm. of the water, and it's like a water bug or something basically attaches to it from the bottom and sort of sucks its guts out. So she watches this frog admiring it, and then all of a sudden it's crumpled in front of her like a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of the rule of nature. And so for her, the real wonder then is that even within that, we can find little traces and hints of order.
I don't understand. Know.
Does that kind of...
There wasn't understand. Anything disorderly about the eating of the frog.
Exactly.
Right.
It's in the order of nature.
That they have to eat and yeah. survive.
I mean, if he wasn't eaten by the bug, a great blue heron would have come and nailed him.
Right.
Yeah. Can I go back to the bards of your own existence thing?
Sure.
For a second. Like, when you first read that, I thought... Man, that sounds so, like, I don't know, American or something. So, like,
okay.
I can create my own mm-hmm. self, basically. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But as I started chewing on that, I thought, well, like, what's the alternative? I got married about the same time as my best friend, and their first date was at our wedding, and so I felt a little bit like, oh, that's my fault that you're married. And so as they started to struggle early in their marriage, I remember having a discussion with him where he was talking about all the arguments that he and his wife were having, and yet they had this beautiful story about how they had come together and their pasts and everything, and it looked like it was going to be, you know, happily ever after, but they're just arguing, and I was like, brilliantly sat back and I said, you know, you really need to think of your relation, the shape of your relationship, not as an argument, but as a narrative, right? You need to think of it as a story and not a syllogism where you're arguing over who's right and who's wrong, but, you know, it's going somewhere, whatever. And I think he thought that was brilliant, but it didn't help, actually. at least at the moment it didn't, but... you know, so, like, what is the alternative if you're not the bard in some sense of your own existence? If you're not gathering the pieces of your existence and sort of putting them out in a narratival shape and placing yourself somewhere in the storyline, you've inherited something from the past and you're headed somewhere in the future, and that story arc is beautiful. I mean, is the only other alternative to viewing the shape of one's life that way that it's syllogistic, that your identity is is, I am this, I am this, and I am this, and I'm not this, and therefore I am this.
Right.
You know?
Do you become?
I wonder if that's the. I mean, because you know, we talk about beauty is in the story, but when you get all nuts and bolts and logical about everything, that's
yeah.
when it gets grotesque. Maybe so. I don't know
yeah.
if you reflect on that.
Sort of the idea of whether we become kind of reduced to these component parts. I don't know. I don't know if this answers it, but as you were talking about that, I was thinking of another book by McCarthy that I didn't include in this discussion, but I think so much of his work is of a piece in that it all addresses and explores and asks questions about the same sorts of things. He has a novel, it's an early novel, I believe it was his third novel, he wrote while he was living in Tennessee, and it's a story of a man called, his name was Lester Ballard, and Ballard is a murderer, and he is displaced from his home, his family home, I believe because of some land acquisition from the Tennessee Valley Authority, and he's sort of left to wander the woods, and eventually he's living in these caves. But because he's a wanted man, you know, he's being pursued. And the novel ends with this image in a medical research facility where Ballard's brain, after he's dead, where Ballard's brain and heart and intestines and things like that are just being weighed and analyzed, and someone's inevitably writing a thesis on him. And, you know, at no point in the story do you get a sense that he is this bard of his own existence, that he is articulating anything other than, well, maybe a desire for a home and maybe a desire for a family or something like that, but it's so buried. It's buried beneath this just intrinsic urge towards violence. So everything is just confused. And, you know, it ends tragically, but it certainly doesn't begin anywhere better. But to me, you know, you have a story like that. And you have a story of this man who is essentially reduced quite literally to his component parts. This is how much your heart weighs. This is how much your brain weighs. And at the end of Cities of the Plain, we're looking at Billy Parham, and he's finding some sense of home and relief for maybe two or three pages. And yet, you know, that sense of, we know who you are, and we know why you're here, you know, we know your story. It's such an incredible contrast. So I don't know if that offers kind of a parallel to what you were saying, but that's another way that I think that operates, at least.
Well, it's strange that you mentioned the violence
stuff
as being the alternative to narrative, because there, you know, it wasn't so much my buddy as his wife that was inclined to throw pots and pans at him. And so I very literally had his own like physical well-being in mind when I was being all cutesy with these narrative.
Well, I mean, I don't mistake me. Violence is part of the narrative. It has to be. And in McCarthy, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that. But it's more about this sense of articulating your place, I guess. But even in his work, it's that's so slippery, and that's so in moments where you feel that the characters have some sort of clarity, then that vanishes and it comes back. But you know, I guess that's life, right?
Yeah. Can I interject a comment rather than a question?
Sure. Right.
Because it adds a third point to this, because if the alternatives are I'm defining my own reality or somebody else is defining my reality, I follow a thinker called Richard Pratt, mm-hmm. and he always tries to keep things in tension between private judgment, present community, and historical perspective. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's some balance between that.
Mm-hmm.
So Martin Luther wakes up one day and says, you know what? I think we've lost sight of justification. Well, all of a sudden, his private judgment has hit the roof mm-hmm. because he is going against present community, but is reaching back to something, you know, way the heck back in history. Yeah. And so, I don't know, I wonder if that's a balancing point. The present community can guide us, but maybe they can also misguide us. We mm-hmm. can have the most brilliant insight, or we've just repeated a heresy and we didn't realize it,
yeah.
or a dead end. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if there isn't some safety in walking all three of those intention.
Yeah, I like the idea of those three factors being intention. I'm not familiar with that. I'm not familiar with that thinker, but it sounds like this is sort of his way of how to describe philosophical or sort of theological evolution, in a sense that one thing takes precedence over the other because these other elements are maybe out of balance, or
we have to be careful.
Okay.
You know, if we're standing alone against what our present community is telling us with clarity, mm-hmm. and what maybe the vast majority, what has been the majority report down through the ages, mm-hmm. we may need to be careful.
Yeah.
It's possible that we're breaking ground. You know, Picasso's cubism,
sure.
or, you know, clearly he's breaking ground. Mm-hmm. But so that's all I'm saying.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Consider for a moment that you have this character in the story, and he's making observations about his own existence. He's trying to figure out his place in it. Well, he's a character in the story. Who really knows the character's place in that story? The person writing the story
sure.
knows the character's place in the story. Anything the character says has been determined by the author of that story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really, what does the author want the message to be? And we don't determine our place. I can say whatever I want about it, but I lack knowledge that is key to figuring out what my place is in the story.
Mm-hmm.
The person writing the story is the only one who has authority to say, this is what your place is in this story, character of mine.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I agree with that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if authors always have that kind of control over their characters.
Mm-hmm.
At least when we're talking about writing fiction. Now, if you're making if this is a larger, analog to a much grander argument, I can't make any claims there. But I know at least when it comes to fiction, I don't know. I think characters are slippery. I think that they have other things that they can reveal about maybe their intentions mm-hmm. that come up and aren't readily available in the moment of creation, I guess. But to me, that's more of my way of thinking also just about the writing process. That, you know, you sort of start here and maybe you have a grand purpose in mind, but you're surprised. You're surprised along the way. Yeah.
I totally agree with that. I mean, I've heard any number of authors say that they don't know where the character is going to end up, and they're surprised.
Sure.
But even, and I've never written fiction, but I write a column and done it for a long time. And I start off with an idea, and sometimes it's a very straight path.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, it goes through a lot of rabbit trails, and sometimes ends up where I never suspected it to go.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Well, just to paraphrase the death of the author, Roland Barthes, I mean,
yeah.
if we only interpret a novel or a painting or a poem based on what the author's intention was, then that just shuts down meaning, and also the identity of the author becomes a singular monolithic thing.
Mm-hmm.
That then really weighs down any other interpretation. So if we want to go back to a tripartite kind of structure, you have the text or the art object,
mm-hmm.
the reader,
right.
the viewer, and then the creator. And then there's that fluid movement
mm-hmm.
Between them. As you know, that's why you can read a Renaissance painting through Freudian theory because we're allowed to do that. You know,
yeah.
because Michelangelo might have intended that. But we can still play with that, and it's a valid.
valid interpretation. So the work, certainly, once it goes out to the world, has a life of its own.
Yeah, definitely. Any other questions? Fine. Seem to,
I was just, as you were reading it, I was struck by the contrast between vision, which is often regarded as the highest, purest, most ignoble sense, and the visceral quality of so much of the descriptions of vision.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that friction.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if that was something that was coming out of your paper, like something you had noticed, or it was something that just runs throughout those writers.
I feel like if it's there, I don't know that I intentionally put it there. So again, here we are. Here we are confirming that.
You're taking credit.
Yeah. I wish that I could, but...
It's a valid interpretation.
But I don't know. I think that vision, for Vision and Hannah and McCarthy and Dillard as well, it is a violent act in a way, because you're seeing and you're forcing a scene into something, and yeah, you're right, there is it's as if the sight sort of triggers something right there in the gut. Well, there's the passage from Dillard, she talks about the two different ways of seeing, and you know, that in the second way, when she's seeing without the camera, you know, the image is inscribed, as she says, on her own silver gut. And she takes that right out of Emerson, who says that we, I forget which essay it's in. It might be Nature. I don't know. Sometimes they all run together. But he says that we are the silver element, I believe. And he's talking about the way that we see and the way that we experience the world is less about our faculty for sight and more about the way that the world around us, the things we see, react in us and cause an image or an idea to appear. Actually, I think that might be in the poem. But just that idea of the bridge between sight and something much deeper, more like intuition,
yeah,
you know.
I mean, just like that passage of like seeing and then the silver is in the gut, I mean, that just completely like cuts through that false hierarchy of the senses and, you know, conflates, you know, the highest and lowest in that, you know, in that one moment.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say for Dillard and your conclusions that would the gut precede the visual sight? Or would they be tandem? Would one be inherent hierarchy over the other?
I think that maybe, I don't know that it's necessarily hierarchy, but I think that maybe there something significant happens, obviously, when, you know, when we're seeing and we are, we're observing something very specific, you know, we're taking a photo of something, or we're recording something, you know, for posterity. But then when we're seeing without those apparatuses of permanence, we become a different type of seer. Then we're more open in a way. We're more open to the world, and more open to the things that are being perceived, because then not only are we seeing, but we're also, of course, being seen, and we're reacting in a much different way, rather than, say, when we're trying to save something or trying to sort of stop time and just picture that thing right out the window there.
Right.
You know, I don't know if that answers
a little bit
what you're saying.
It means I'm probably going to have to do some reading and thinking about this aspect of intuitive knowledge. It's been brought up before. I've heard it from my friend Maku Fujimura. He's talked a bit about Mm-hmm. Intuitive knowledge being more important than observed. I don't know if he uses the word observed knowledge, but yeah, I wonder if the word imagination could possibly be used there too, because I've been doing some reading and thinking in regards to that, especially in relationship to the Inklings, C.S. Okay. Lewis and Tolkien. And
yeah.
So they had a tension between Lewis had the tension between his reason and then this aspect of what really made his soul fly. He was based in his modern analytical knowledge, but then would come across lines like Balder the Brave is dead, and it would just cause him to really fly, and he didn't know why. And I've wondered sometimes if the imagination is related to that aspect of the intuitive knowledge, not that it's divorced from the reason. Because that was the very thing I think Tolkien addressed when they were talking about the Christ. When they were talking about Jesus, he brings the reason and that intuitive imagination together, because the myth becomes reality. Is what the argument was.
Okay.
So I'm just thinking about that.
Well, you know, I don't have an answer there, and I wish that I knew more about this notion of intuitive knowledge, and in my field it's often called affect theory. That's sort of a new school of literary criticism, which seems to be a new one every month, but I think there it can branch off and tie into a lot of different things as an outgrowth of what was called a reader response theory, which there are multiple shades of that, but I think the idea, if I have a very basic understanding of affect theory at all, I think the idea there is, well, that you have this apparatus of understanding these texts and kind of making your way through these texts within you because of, you know, the experiences and stuff that you've had, and that that, say, maybe you read a poem or a line like that, and it really sets something off in you.
Right.
Well, maybe that's tied to some, you know, psychological reason or whatever, but it could also be tied to something, you know, bigger, like just the, you know, the poetic encounter of what we might call the sublime,
right?
And the difference there between, to me, the difference between intuitive knowledge and that sort of rational knowledge might even be the difference between the sublime and the beautiful. It might be, you know, not that one is better or worse than the other, but that one is maybe deliberately ordered. Well, maybe they're both deliberately ordered, but that one inspires a different sort of reaction and awe that registers on a slightly different level than the other. But that's kind of where my mind is going there.
Right,
so
right.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm still kind of playing with that idea, but that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm reading a friend of Lewis's, Owen Barfield, who is his book Poetic Diction, talked about way a human grows, changes of consciousness through reading things like, you know, drama, reading poetry and other types of things. And he said Lewis's contribution to that phrase was that it's a felt change of consciousness. So not an emotional necessarily, but something about you changes.
Yeah.
And you feel it.
Yeah.
So it is something, a reality, but only you can, because you're the individual. But
right.
Philip Barfield began to talk about that in the context even of a common consciousness among the community, which kind of breaks into a little
That's
bit of what Ray is talking about, I think, with community and then history. But we have probably time for one more question. Pope, I think you had it, and then we got a break.
I like your intuition idea. You don't land on Earth with intuition unless God whispered in your ear something, because intuition comes from knowledge. You can collect it, you can read it, you can do it through research or you just experience, but you have to put something in here and see things or hear things, and you store it all up. And wisdom is knowledge informed by experience. And so in working with experts in fields, my students have felt they have really researched a topic, and man, they've got it. They can go ahead and do this slide tape unit, and they'll have it nailed. And I'll say, no, take that over to Dr. So-and-so. He's been doing this for 20 years, and he's seen hundreds of patients. Let him have a go at it.
Right.
Because that wisdom informed by experience, they feel things in their gut. Their brain, you're saying a phrase or something will cue something. Mm-hmm. Your brain connects the dots. And so a phrase or something, all of a sudden these dots line up. And these are these, oh my gosh, moments. Mm-hmm. Why didn't I see this before? But then you take it to someone who's got that experience. He feels an intuitive response to this. And he nails points, just bing, bing, bing. Mm-hmm. And he gets it right. Whereas you think you've got it right as a newbie just doing the research with really good stuff.
Yeah,
right.
But the guy who deals with it every day has this wonderful intuition about it. And the only way you get it is experience.
Mm-hmm. And it could be related to the what you're talking about with intuitive. I mean, I think of...
Dot connecting is kind of crazy, but that's what your brain does.
It's making connections.
Right, the difference between actually reading about how to sail a boat and then actually sailing.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's like, well,
damn,
yeah.
You're drowning.
And some of, not that that reading is in not valuable, because it would give you knowledge, but then when you try to actually apply it, maybe there's something to that, which is why we're gathering to talk about this so that we can all think more deeply about it. But. Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts for us, Joseph, in this?
I don't know.
Are you going to be around with us for the rest of the day?
Yeah,
perhaps?
I will.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
I'll be around.
And we can kick this stuff around.
Yeah, definitely.
What do you got here, Tom? Thanks. Let's thank Joseph.